The Guardian. Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, and 24/7 support. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Anne Perkins. You only have to look at the US government shutdown of last month, or the inability of Western governments to agree what to do about Syria, to get the sense that democracy is not in rude health. As Winston Churchill famously said, it might be the worst form of government, except for all the others that have been tried. But that's not how it looks from Beijing or Moscow, where heads of government can get things done without worrying too much about the ballot box. It's a concern that's occupied the political scientist David Runciman for some time, and is the focus of his latest book, The Confidence Trap. David joins me now. David, explain to me why you felt you wanted to write this book, and yeah. what the book's for.
I started thinking about it around the time of the crash in 2008, and it was my own genuine bafflement as to whether democracy was going to be able to cope. I think, like lots of people, I felt really conflicted, because I thought, on the one hand, it's the only system we've got, there didn't seem to be any alternative, seems to work in the long run. And on the other hand, you look at it and you think it's just a mess. And then you think about the long 21st century stretching ahead, and you think, is this really going to last? So what motivated me, I'm a historian, was to use history, look back at past crises and try and work out how people had thought through that dilemma in the past.
Tell me what it was particularly about the crash, though, that made you so frustrated. I mean, on one level, democracy worked in the way it's worked in the past. It kind of absorbed the energy of the blow, didn't it?
It absorbed the shock and it muddled through, and my book is about how democracy's muddled through. But then you look at it and you think, yeah, we survived. And I've been writing the book over the period that we have sort of muddled our way through this, from 2008 till last year. So I was thinking about it during the 4 years that we were stumbling along, and then the euro crisis blew up and we teetered to the edge of the cliff and we teeter back, and then the past few weeks American government shuts down, and you see these repeated patterns. And there's partly a sense that it'll be fine because the pattern will repeat itself. And then there's that underlying sense, and I don't think I'm alone in feeling this, that you can't carry on like this forever. And you think that you muddle through every crisis. What if you get the crisis that it doesn't muddle through? And not every crisis is the same, and it's not as though the 21st century is going to repeat the 20th century. So I think at the end of the book about future challenges like climate change, and you think, well, isn't it a bit complacent just to assume that the pattern will always repeat itself?
I can see why a Labour government didn't want to say, woo, I think we better stop spending. It's harder to see why they didn't say to the city, you're not really quite as robust as you think you are. But it's more extraordinary that there's been no pressure to make those changes subsequently. And that seems to me like a serious failing in democracy.
Yeah, and I think it is. I'd say that the way in the book that I try and think about this is the kind of tension between the short term and the long term with democracy. I mean, democracy is a short term form of politics. That's how it works. It runs through new cycles and electoral cycles. It's very hard under a democratic system to think about the distant future. But that's its strength as well. Because it keeps chopping and changing, it doesn't get stuck, its mistakes are the ones that can absorb. What we've seen since the crisis is a kind of patching up of the system. People don't actually behave in an ideological way, they behave in a pragmatic way. The difficulty is then taking the longer view, and that's the thing that democracies find incredibly hard.
And doesn't it, the fact that it finds it very hard means that we're going to have the same crisis all over again?
Yeah. But in the book, I do crises every 10 to 15 years. This one has gone on longer, actually. I do it. I take particular crisis years, so one of the years is 2008. We're not in the same crisis as 2008. It's morphed since then. But I think everyone feels that this crisis isn't quite over yet. So if it happens every 10 to 15 years, the next one will come almost before this one has finished. But there are also longer-term crises as well, and this might be one of the 40-year crises. You get the 30s and the Great Depression, you get the 1970s and the move to neoliberalism, and this could be one of those bigger cycles in which we are going to have to undergo a fundamental shift, and that is very, very dangerous and difficult for democracies, I think.
So why do you think it succeeds when it does succeed? How did democracy in Britain survive? And it's very easy to forget how fragile it was in those years. What do you think were the features of the political scene or democracy itself that enabled democracy to survive and Britain to go into and fight the Second World War as a democracy?
Yeah, I mean, the 30s and the 70s are the two periods where I think it's easy, like you say, to forget just how fragile it was and just how many people assumed that it wouldn't survive. In the 1930s, democracy was in the retreat everywhere, in the United States even, as well as here, certainly across Europe. And there was a sense that this system just couldn't cope because it couldn't match the decisiveness of the dictatorships. It wasn't robust enough. But what it was more pragmatic. And it's that pragmatism that elected politicians will do whatever it takes to remain in office. And that, looked at in some lights, is obviously a weakness because it makes them look unprincipled and it makes them look devious. But it also makes them incredibly adaptable. And so if you had to say one word that sums up why democracies survive, it's their adaptability. And non-democratic systems have some strengths, including decisiveness. Their ultimate weakness is the lack of adaptability. So adaptability is a reassuring feature of democracy, but it's not enough because you can't just always assume you can change your way out of it.
But it is, just to dwell on it for a moment, it is interesting, isn't it? Because if you look at the 30s, the governments of the 30s in particular got a lot of stick for not rearming. Yeah. But rearming would have involved cutting even further the limited amount of social support that there was available. Yeah. Similarly, not treating with the unions as the Labour government did in the 1970s, a time of extraordinary income equality, if nothing else, might have precipitated a greater crisis. And indeed, arguably, we were already coming out of the crisis when Thatcher arrived with a solution to the crisis that had already been resolved.
I absolutely agree with that the politicians who look like the kind of ones, the decisive, semi-dictatorial ones who come in and shake democracy up are often surfing a tide of adaptable change. I think that's true of Thatcher. I think it was true of Reagan in the United States as well. But during these crises, both in the 30s and the 70s, there was this sense that the really tough decisions, the politicians wouldn't be able to take them. And the reason that democracy would collapse, it was thought, in the 30s and the 70s, is that no elected politician would have the guts. And particularly in the 70s, if you read newspaper comment, as I did for the book, it's just full of this sense that the politicians lack the courage. Why do they lack the courage? Because they're worried about the electorate. But the other side of that lacking the courage is that they also don't get stuck with ideological convictions. And so in the 30s, for instance, the government that devalued was essentially the nationalist government that had always said it never would do that. And at the time, people said, this is why democracy doesn't work. You know, these people have no idea what they're doing. But thank God they didn't stick to their principles. That was what saved them. And that is the feature of democracy. You see it across the 20th century. Politicians, I mean, George W. Bush in 2008, free market politician. It took him 20 minutes to change his mind when Lehman Brothers went down. Dictators don't do that, partly because their power depends upon sticking to their guns. Democratic politicians do that because their power depends on changing.
So maybe you and I are sitting here demonstrating what you say is one of the big weaknesses of democracy, which is complacency.
And that's... So I've written a book that it's only been out for a while, and I've been told that it's both depressing and cynical and complacent and rose-tinted. And I think, well, maybe that means it's neither, or maybe it means it's both. That's the risk. But yes, there is... I mean, it is the perennial temptation of a democratic system to think it's never as bad as it looks. But sometimes it is as bad as it looks. And the difficulty is getting a sense of perspective on it within the electoral cycle. And I think the current crisis is a particularly difficult and dangerous one because the muddling through started very early. I mean, the difference with the 30s in America is Roosevelt. You know, the remarkable thing about Roosevelt, and he was a very courageous politician, was he gets elected in October 1932, 5 months then between election and inauguration, during which the world is falling apart, and he does nothing. And he won't say anything or do anything. And it's because he wants it to get so bad that when he assumes office, he has the mandate for change. Obama is not that kind of politician. It wasn't that kind of crisis. And Obama, Brown, all of the elected leaders of the Western world started the muddling through very, very early. So we haven't had those kind of cathartic moments or those moments where people seem to get a sense of just how the crisis had sort of focused on a particular point. And there is that danger that the complacency kicks in fairly early on. The euro crisis is not over, but there's a sense that we've muddled through. British economy is starting to pick up. The American economy is starting to pick up. And yet American politics seems as dysfunctional as ever. European politics seems as dysfunctional as ever. I don't feel complacent about it, but I know it's a danger of this historical perspective. You look at 100 years, 2, 3, 4, 5 year crises look like blips, but sometimes they're not.
One of the things that occurs to me is that maybe And I think that's certainly in terms of voter engagement and voter turnout, it's as true of the States as here, that maybe, you know, we have all the trappings of democracy without really having a very democratic society.
The trappings of democracy are crucial. So electoral politics is still the thing that determines it. You can kick governments out when enough people are pissed off with them. That's a democracy. But disengagement is greater than it has ever been. And there is an argument here, is that a reflection of complacency or is that a reflection of a kind of impatience and despair about? And it's I think it's always a bit of both. I mean, when things get really serious, you know, countries where there is not voter disengagement that are ostensibly democracies like Iraq are not better off than we are because 85-90% of the population vote. The reason they vote is because the elections are so crucial for their immediate future. So there is a kind of... There is a ambivalence in this disengagement, which is it's partly a reflection of, broadly speaking, a sense that the system will sort itself out.
I
was getting to the or. You give it to me.
Or people feel that it can't change the things that matter
exactly,
to them.
Exactly, the Russell Brand view. We have to get on to him eventually. Yeah, absolutely. But again, it's a striking feature of the present crisis, if you compare it to previous ones through the 20th century, that people are disengaged and there's a sense, oh, does this really work? But also, there's very little talk about an alternative system. So even the great revolutionary of the moment, Russell Brand, he's not telling us about an alternative system. He's just telling us to disengage. You know, disengagement is not a revolutionary program. In the 70s, in the 60s, the 50s, the 40s, the 30s, the 20s, democracy seemed to be under pressure from the appeal of rival systems of government. And in Britain now, I'm not, with one or two exceptions, there's almost no one who's saying we should move to the Chinese system or we should adopt Venezuelan-style democratic socialism. There are, of course, a few people saying that, but in compared to, say, the 70s, where mainstream political talk was rife with a sense that there were rivals pressing in on us. And that does produce a kind of both a sort of apathy and a sense that this is the only thing out there and it doesn't work. What do you do? It's understandable to pull back from it. And that could be more dangerous, actually, that these rivals in the past sort of kept democracy honest.
I mean, that's a really sort of interesting and important point, isn't it? But one of the correlation to the disengagement is what we've learned in the last 6 months about the operation of the securocracy and the covert surveillance. Mm. Which is potentially an equal and an undermining threat. And I wonder whether we have the capacity to rein that in.
It's a very, very difficult question. Certainly, it is true that it is thanks to the fact that we are a democracy that we know about it. And democracies they drift, people disengage. Secret pockets of power, surveillance and control build up in democracies, and this is a repeated pattern. And then, thanks to a free press primarily, these things come out. The question is, at what point does democracy re-engage to control it? And one of the things I talk about in the book is the difference between scandals and crises. And what scandals often do, and it's a really interesting question whether currently this question about the surveillance society is being treated as a kind of scandal, which doesn't tend to change much. It's sort of arouses a certain amount of public anger, but it quite quickly dissipates? Or is it a real crisis of democracy, at which point there does usually become a re-engagement by the system? And at the moment, I think it's unclear which way it's going to go. I think it might actually turn out to be a genuine crisis of democracy.
Well, one of the interesting things and revealing is the varied responses, you know, in Europe and in America and in Britain. And particularly in Germany and here and in the States. I mean, what does that tell you about the nature of our different systems or the things that matter?
So I've been talking about democracy, and it's easy to talk about Western democracy. They're very different, and they have very, very different historical experiences and memories. And in Germany, I think it's a result of the fact that German democracy was set up in the aftermath of the Second World War, in the aftermath of the most extreme surveillance society, and then East German democracy that's been folded into Western German democracy is itself. So Germans are profoundly conscious of this, both constitutionally and culturally. Again, in the United States, there's a kind of suspicion of government. And in Britain, for various reasons, there is less suspicion of government. So people often say, and I hear it a lot in Cambridge with people who come from the United States, from Europe, and the first thing they notice is the CCTV culture. And they say, why are you guys not freaked out by being recorded all the time? You know, in Germany, this would be absolute anathema. And you think, well, it's because we just kind of are used to it. And it is a form of complacency. And certainly the polling, you'll know this better than me, the polling in Britain shows less anxiety about these revelations than it does in other parts of the world. So these democracies are very, very different, and they will, the systems will react in different ways. That's for sure, I think.
Do you think it makes the British system the more vulnerable, that we have had a less robust response?
Yeah, and in a sense, the vulnerability of a system is often a reflection of the fact that it hasn't in the past been tested to quite such an extreme extent. So it's a reflection of success in a way, that the British system has evolved in a way under basic liberal freedoms that we've become relatively, although it's going down all the time, but relatively comfortable with the idea of a political or security elite keeping an eye on us in certain ways, whereas other systems that have much more experience of how it goes wrong, fundamentally wrong, are much more suspicious. But then you want to say, well, so we need a really bad experience of it to wake us up to it. And you think, well, this one is pretty bad. How much worse does it have to get? And that's always the question in a crisis. How much worse does it have to get before people wake up to it?
It's interesting that the reaction in the States has been so angry, because they have experienced among the worst things one can imagine in terms of 9/11. And of course, that there's a kind of sort of clear causal link between then and now. But what this surveillance state depends on is our fear of terror. And that's arguably always the biggest threat to liberal democracy, is something that challenges its fundamental assumptions, but in a very kind of invidious, not overt way.
But so in the United States, the fear of terror is rivaled by the fear of federal government, which doesn't exist in the same way in Britain. The idea that, you know, local politics has to be protected from Washington. And Washington has a kind of bogey quality in American politics, and then the security establishment around that, which we don't have here. So those two things are rivaling each other. And it is interesting that 12 years on from 9/11, but only 4 or 5 years on from the crash, it's the fear of Washington that's outdoing the fear of terror, because the Tea Party is a response to the sense that central government has become this distant and oppressive thing. And that seems to be the dominant narrative. And it is striking, though, the relationship between Tea Party politics and the American response to the surveillance society is very complex. But there are these streams in American politics that do channel that sense of suspicion of democratic politics at the centre, which can be both a positive and a negative thing.
One of the most depressing things that you say is that you can't force the pace of democracy. Right. What are the implications of that insight in terms of how we meet the challenges that we can see ahead?
And it's particularly depressing or frightening if you think that the pace of everything else is speeding up. I mean, this is a fast-moving world in lots of respects than anything even imaginable in the last century, the 20th century. Democratic politics used to depend upon there being a certain amount of time for the system to adjust. And there is less time. The terrifying feature of the 2008 crisis was that it was down to hours, literally hours, for governments to save the banks that would save the system. And yet politics does still work in democracies on these cycles of 3, 4, 5 years. And it is very hard. Those attempts to speed it up tend to be undemocratic. I mean, that's the thing that the Chinese system can do better than our system, which is, faced with a short-term crisis, doesn't need public consultation, doesn't need to be so responsive to public opinion. It can act, and ours can't. And that tension may well get worse, that the imperative for quick action pushes up against the sense that democratic systems adjust over electoral cycles.
And it may get worse, and then...
Well, so I try and stick it over like apocalyptic scenarios, because democracies do not tend to collapse. In a way, the example I think that is the most useful one for current Western democracy is Japan over the past 20 years, where systems get stuck. They don't fall apart. They don't collapse into fascism. You don't get anarchy on the streets. What you get is a system that never quite catches up. And there are worse things than what's happened to Japan in the last 20 years, and Japan may now be coming out of that. No one's quite sure. But to get stuck for 20 years is not good, particularly with aging populations, heavy burden of debt and so on, and then huge challenges like climate change and technology. But that seems to me the likeliest response, which is that democratic politics is always a bit too slow and the adaptation comes a little bit too late. The one where that's really threatening is climate change, because if it is true that the adaptation always comes a bit too late with things like terrorism and war and even economic collapse, you can usually muddle your way out. But there may be certain things where if the runaway effects kick in around the time that you're adapting, then you're in real trouble.
Because, of course, the real challenge about climate change is that we need to act before we can see why.
Before we wake up. Exactly. What are the kinds of politicians that can do that? In a way, certain kinds of populist politics can wake people up and galvanise people, but they don't tend to do it around issues like this. You know, Nigel Farage, part of his appeal as a populist politician is telling people that climate change is bunkum. Populist politics tends to be very, very short-termist. But in a way, so what you want is a kind of galvanizing politician with a long-term perspective. And democracies don't actually produce those, depressingly.
One of the aspects of politics that was rather fashionable in the sort of 19th and early 20th century is people kind of came to terms with the idea of mass suffrage, which I think is one of the kind of most astonishing achievements in history. Was this idea that political leadership was actually about education, and it was about explaining to people that they had choices and they were responsible for the choices they made. And that seems to have gone altogether. This is maybe rather a pessimistic observation, but I suppose one kind of hopes that somebody can come along with a kind of charisma. Funny enough, I noted someone below the line saying about something I wrote about Russell Brand. We need Russell Brands. We need heroes. Yeah, yeah. We need leaders. And maybe we do need a Russell Brand figure who can persuade people to take climate change seriously.
Yeah. And it's true. I mean, one has to avoid sort of thinking that past politicians were kind of better at it than our ones. I mean, Gladstone and so on, they probably did have a higher-minded view about political education than our current lot did, but I think they found it just as hard. And one of the things that... So my hero in this book is Tocqueville, the great 19th-century French writer about democracy and America and so on. And one of his lines, and he and John Stuart Mill agreed about this, both of them completely committed to the idea of democratic education, terrified that these new democracies would give power to people who were not fit to use it. But they also understood that the way you learn stuff is by making mistakes. I mean, they both thought that the key to democratic education was a form of responsibility, as they thought for personal education, that just thinking teachers can do it is never enough. It's never book learning, it's experience. And as I say in my book, one of the frightening things about that is it's fine for an individual, but whole societies have to make these mistakes to learn. And Tocqueville's fear about America was that it would never make serious enough mistakes to learn from them because it was such a privileged country. It's kind of true, although obviously it has learned from some of its mistakes. And that's the challenge with democracy. There is an aspect to democratic education, which is people feel empowered not simply by knowledge, but also by experience. And that's why disengagement is so dangerous. So I'm not sure Russell Brand is going to be the educator here. I'm not sure that message is the one. It's that sort of, well, now if you really feel responsible for this, you have to take on board the responsibility of the mistakes. And in a democracy, it's hard to get that process off the ground.
One of the ways that people, including democracy being a very fashionable subject for books at the moment, one of the things that Phil Coggins had suggested in his book was that, you know, you kind of need to kind of give the people better ways of expressing their opinions and more frequent ways of expressing their opinions, and which of course is now technologically possible. Against that, you have this government, which has introduced a kind of complete anomaly in British political history, which is the 5-year fixed term parliament. And I wonder whether maybe we need both of those things, or maybe we already have, in a way, because we have this constant opinion polling, we already do have a very, politicians do already have a very clear sense of where the electorate is. And is that a facilitating or indeed an obstruction to good governance?
I mean, certainly I think it is true that if people feel there is no outlet for their opinion under a democratic system, there will be huge frustration. The challenge is always channeling it. There can be too much of this stuff. It can come out in all these different forms. But I absolutely agree with you. It is striking that Britain has gone to a 5-year electoral cycle, which is long by contemporary standards. And it feels long, right? I mean, around now, we would normally be feeling, surely it's time to have another go because this isn't working. But we're going to wait for another 18 months. And in that context, it is a real challenge to find the outlets that people feel, they have to feel that they have some purchase. It's not just enough to constantly ask people how you feel. Is it annoying you? Do you like them? That's the real challenge. And I don't think anyone's worked out yet how to use the technology in that way. And the utopianism of sort of 15 years ago about online democracy, e-democracy, referenda or something, it's really faded.
It's just another way of not taking part, isn't it?
It's another way of not taking part. But that doesn't mean that the challenge isn't still there and that the technology isn't at some point. But it's not, you know, this isn't technological determinism. The technology is not going to suddenly throw up the solution. Google is not going to invent Google democracy and then we'll all go, oh, that's how it works. It'll require a politician or a political process to work out a way of engaging the public through the technology with these long electoral cycles within which there's a huge amount of frustration at the pace of change. But it's a huge challenge, I think.
What would you like people then to take away from your book? How would you like them to feel? Well, how would you like them to feel it when they put it down?
Yeah, not that it is both cynical and rose-tinted. So the point of it, and historians always say this, is you do get a perspective if you take a long view, a 100-year view. You do see, on the one hand, the sense in which a lot of this is a repeat of a pattern that's been there before. But you also, I think, get a sense of how over those 100 years, certain problems have built up. And we are at a point now where it's not enough to rely on this cycle of change and renewal to get us through it. And it is as hard as it has ever been. And it's partly as hard as it has ever been. And it's one of the things I do say, and it's really easy to forget this. We are just so much more prosperous. Not everybody, of course, but as a base level, as a democratic society, relative to even 20, 30 years ago, in which one of the galvanizing agents of change was a sense that less prosperous societies are really vulnerable to sort of political upheaval. And we're not. You know, if we survive the 70s, we can certainly survive this as a political system. But within that, the challenges of growing inequality, of sort of structural change, it's harder than ever. I don't know what the answer is, and I didn't at the end of the book feel I knew what the answer was, but I do feel that you can get a perspective on this which gives you a sense that there's a difference between the surface discontent of democracy, which often is not as bad as it looks, and the challenge of structural change, which is often harder than it looks in the light of that surface discontent. And I think it's as hard now as it has ever been, and it will take some politicians of some courage to do it, but there are such politicians. They usually come along. In the 70s, I've written about this, not in the book, but in the 70s, at this point in the cycle, the politicians who were going to claim to have made the difference were nowhere in sight. In 5 years' time, it won't be Russell Brand, but I'm not sure it'll be Ed Miliband either. In 5 years' time, it may not be in Britain, it might be somewhere in Europe. There may be politicians who seem to have a vision for this range of problems, which seems at the moment very, very difficult to achieve.
David Runciman, thank you very much. And David's book, The Confidence Trap, is out now. You can get it from the Guardian Bookshop. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Anne Perkins. Goodbye.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today, no credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code GUARDIAN.